Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
A couple of months ago, my book, By Grace Alone, made it onto Amazon as a Kindle download. We asked $2.99 for the book, and apparently sales have been pretty good, pretty impressive. So the same fellow who very kindly helped us convert By Grace Alone to a Kindle format has done the same thing now with my book, A Guide to New Covenant Giving. And as of yesterday, A Guide to New Covenant Giving is now available as a Kindle download on Amazon. So I have a couple of books up there, and even as I speak, we are working on Is the Church Israel? So I will have three books on Amazon, and then we are discussing whether we will continue from there and put up A Brief History of the Future, which is my eschatology book. So we will see. It's very exciting. I'm very pleased to have this happen. And I can now say to people, oh, why, yes, I am a published author. And so that's a very nice thing. I'm so glad that he did that. We're going to try to cover a lot of ground tonight. Turn to 1 Kings 7. We're going to try to kind of survey chapter 7 because it really is detail and construction information about Solomon's house. And then we get to chapter 8. We'll slow down a bit because that is when the ark is brought into the temple. And I would like to get all the way to Solomon's address to the people and his prayer of dedication in chapter 8. It's a long chapter, chapter 8 is. So I plan to kind of move through chapter 7 reasonably quickly and just kind of summarize it, and then we'll move on. 1 Kings chapter 7, starting at verse 1. Now, actually, chapter 7, verse 1 is a strange place to divide up this information because the very end of chapter 6 told us, starting in verse 37, that it was in the fourth year that the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid, in the month of Ziv, and in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which was the 8th month, the house was finished throughout all its parts according to all its plans. So Solomon was 7 years in building it. Then chapter 7, verse 1 says, now Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished all his house. These two run back to back. There are some commentaries that attempt to say that they were concurrent, that he began work on both the temple and his house at the same time, and it's just that one took longer than the other. But if you go forward in 1 Kings to chapter 9, 1 Kings 9, verse 10 says, and it came about at the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house, that Hiram, king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress timber and gold according to all his desire. And then King Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. So it's very clear. The writer of 1 Kings, probably Jeremiah, takes the time to tell us that it took 20 years in order to accomplish the building of the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. So the house of the Lord, the temple, was finished with its basic construction. But then what you're going to see is that the furnishings for the temple continued being built even as Solomon's house was being built. Now, when you hear the phrase Solomon's house, don't think of a house like where I live or where you live. Solomon's house was actually a great deal more than just that. It was the Hall of Judgment. It was the place where the king's court met. It was where government was enacted. He did also have a living space there. He also built a separate hall and living space for his wife that was Pharaoh's daughter, so she was set up like a queen. And so this was a huge structure that had several different departments and several different compartments in order to accomplish several different things. So when you read Solomon's house and you say, how come it took 7 years to build the temple? and 13 years just to build this guy's house. Well, it was actually the seat of government. So we read, now Solomon was building his own house for 13 years, and he finished all his house. And he built the house from the forest of Lebanon. Its length was 100 cubits, its width 50 cubits, its height 30 cubits, and there were four rows of cedar pillars with cedar beams on all the pillars. Then you can read about how it was paneled. You can read about the windows. You can read about the hall. Look at verse 7. He made a hall for a throne where he was to judge, the hall of judgment, and it was paneled with cedar from floor to floor. And his house where he was to live, the other court inward from the hall, was of the same workmanship. He also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom Solomon had married. All these were of very costly stones, of stone cut according to measure, sawed with saws inside and outside, even from foundation to the coping, and so on the outside of the great court. And the foundation was of costly stones, even large stones, stones of 10 cubits and stones of 8 cubits. And above were costly stones, stone cut measure to measure, and cedar. So the great court all around had three rows of cut stone and a row of cedar beams, even as the inner court of the house of the Lord and the porch of the house. Then starting at verse 13, we read about a fellow named Hiram. This is not Hiram who was the king of Tyre. This is just a fellow who was in Tyre. King Solomon sent and brought Hiram from Tyre. He was a widow's son from the tribe of Naphtali. And his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. And he was filled with wisdom and understanding and skill for doing any work in bronze. So he came to King Solomon and performed all his work. He fashioned two pillars of bronze, and then you get the description of them, 18 cubits tall. You read about the molten bronze tops, the capitals around them, and you read about the networks of chains that connected them. And you can read all those details if you'd like, starting in verse 23. We read about the laver of cleansing that he made. Now, in the tabernacle in the wilderness, there were a couple pieces of furniture that you addressed as soon as you approached the tabernacle. And the first of them was this laver where the priests had to stop and clean themselves. It was polished brass, almost mirror-like, so that they could see themselves. And they would clean themselves before they would go in to perform any of the work for the Lord. Well, Solomon raised the ante on that thing and made a gigantic laver and set it on the back of 12 bulls that were made of brass. And so there's the description starting in verse 23. Now he made a sea of cast metal 10 cubits from brim to brim, circular in form. Its height was 5 cubits and 30 cubits in circumference. And under its brim, there were gourds that went around encircling it, 10 to a cubit, and then completely surrounded the sea, and the gourds were in two rows, cast with the rest. And then it stood on 12 oxen, three facing north, three facing west, three facing south, three facing east, and the sea was set on the top of them, and all their rear parts were turned inward. And it was, this gives you some idea of the brass work, and it was a handbreadth thick. So you're talking about an enormous bowl of bronze full of water for the cleaning, for the cleansing of those people who would serve in the temple. But that was not enough, because anybody who came into the temple was going to need to stop and do some cleaning, some ceremonial washing. And so Hiram also made 10 other smaller lavers of cleansing. Verse 27. Then he made 10 stands of bronze. The length of each stand was 4 cubits, and its width 4 cubits, and its height 3 cubits. And this was the design of the stands. They had borders, even borders between the frames. And on the borders that were between the frames, there were lions, oxen, and cherubim. And on the frames, there was a pedestal above. And beneath the lions and the oxen were wreaths of hanging work. Now each stand had 4 bronze wheels with bronze axles. And its 4 feet had supports. And beneath each basin, cast supports with wreaths were on each side. And its opening inside the crown at the top was a cubit, and its opening was round like the design of the pedestal, a cubit and a half. And also on its opening there were engravings, and the borders were square and not round. And the four wheels underneath the borders and the axle wheels were on the stand. And the height of a wheel was a cubit and a half. And the workmanship of the wheels was like the workmanship of a chariot wheel. Their axles, their rims, their spokes, and their hubs were all cast. And now there were four supports at the four corners of each stand. Its supports were part of the stand itself. And on the top of the stand, there was a circular form, half a cubit high. And on the top of its stand were its stays, and its borders were part of it. And he engraved on the plates of the stays and on the borders cherubim, lions, and palm trees, according to the clear space on each, with wreaths all around. He made the 10 stands like this, all of them of one casting, one measure, and one form, and he made 10 basins of bronze. One basin held 40 baths. Each basin was 4 cubits, and on each of the 10 stands there was one basin, and he set the stands, 5 on the right side of the house and 5 on the left side of the house, and he set the sea of cast metal on the right side of the house eastward toward the south. Okay, that takes us up to verse 40. So basically what you're learning here is that while Solomon's house was being built, at the same time Hiram was doing all of this work for the furnishings that were going to go in the courtyard and surrounding the outside of the temple. Because when you approached the tabernacle in the wilderness, there was the laver of cleansing, and then there was also the altar for the burnt offerings, and then those burnt offerings would be taken into the holy place. Well, same thing. We read last week about the altar that he built and that it was up a series of steps, that it was raised up high. So outside the temple in the first court, as you go into the outer court before you go into the temple proper, in that court you've got this huge laver of cleansing, you've got the raised up altar, and then on both sides of the temple you have these 10 lavers, big bowls of washing, so that everyone could ceremonially clean themselves before they went into the temple. That's what's been described so far. But everything, this is what I want you to see, everything was done fastidiously. Everything was done decoratively. Everything was done for glory and for beauty, because it was going into God's service. And then the end of chapter 40 here just kind of summarizes all the other utensils that Hiram made to be used in the temple. Starting at verse 40, Hiram made the basins and the shovels and the bowls. So Hiram finished doing all the work which he performed for King Solomon in the house of the Lord. He made the two pillars and the two bowls of the capitals that were on the top of the two pillars. And he made two networks to cover the two bowls of the capitals that were on the top of the pillars, and the 400 pomegranates for the two networks, 2 rows of pomegranates for each network to cover the two bowls of the capitals that were on the top of the pillars, and 10 stands with the 10 basins on the stands, and the one sea and the 12 oxen that were under the sea, and the pails and the shovels and the bowls, even all these utensils which Hiram made for King Solomon in the house of the Lord, and they were all polished brass. In the plain of Jordan, the king had them all cast in the clay from the ground between Succoth and Zarethan. And Solomon left all the utensils unweighed because there were too many, and the weight of bronze could not be ascertained. And Solomon made all the furniture that was in the house of the Lord, the gold altar and the golden table on which is the bread of presence, or the table of showbread, and also the lampstands, 5 on the right side, 5 on the left. In front of the inner sanctuary, he made those of pure gold, and the flowers, and the lamps, and the tongs of gold, and the cups, and the snuffers, and the bowls, and the spoons, and the fire pans were all of pure gold, and the hinges, both for the doors of the inner house, the most holy place, and for doors of the house, that is, of the nave, were of gold. Thus all the work that King Solomon performed in the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things dedicated by his father David, the silver and the gold and the utensils, and he put all of them in the treasury of the house of the Lord. So the building of the house of Solomon, the building of the house of the Lord, everything was made for beauty, was made for splendor, was made for God's glory, and they made so much, the utensils were so much, the weight of the bronze and the gold was so much, that they just quit counting. Can you imagine the magnificence of this place? Can you imagine walking in and seeing that? That's why it took 7 years to build the outer shell and another 13 to get it all outfitted and ready to go. Well, once all that's done, there's only one piece that's really missing, the essential piece. And that takes us to chapter 8, when they bring the Ark of the Covenant into the temple. And this is a big deal. You will notice that you don't see this same kind of emphasis for anything else. God said that there had to be the candlestick, the menorah. Well, it's mentioned that he made that, and he made it of gold. And God said that there needed to be a table of showbread. And we're told, well, he made that, and that was there. God told them that there had to be the laver of cleansing. Okay, they did that, and they installed it. Had to be an altar, raised up. He did all that, that's fine. But when it came to bringing the ark, whole other thing, because this was the center of their worship. This is the place where God would actually appear between the angels that were on the top of the Kapparath. This was the piece of furniture that was in the holiest place. This was the piece of furniture that nobody could touch. You had to put staves through it, and they had to carry it on their shoulders. And if anyone even reached out to stabilize it, people died. No. This was the holiest object in Israel's possession. So when it came time to bring this into the temple, Solomon made a very big to-do. Chapter 8, verse 1. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the fathers' households of the sons of Israel, to King Solomon in Jerusalem to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from the city of David, which is in Zion. They didn't do that for any other piece of furniture. Every other piece of furniture was built by Hiram, designed, and put in place. But when it came time to bring the ark, he gathered everybody. Get the leaders, get the tribal leaders, bring the heads of the families. This is a big deal. And all the men of Israel assembled themselves to King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month. And all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark. You might recall that in order for the ark to travel, it had to be on the shoulders of priests. Common people couldn't carry it. Common people couldn't take it. And so all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of the Lord, and they brought the tent of meeting with all the holy utensils which were in the tent, and the priests and the Levites brought them up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled to him were with him before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. In other words, we're bringing the ark of God into our midst, sacrifice the whole way. So as it traveled, you know, make a little distance, kill something. Make a little distance, kill something. They killed so many animals as that ark progressed that they lost count because they were constantly, continually sacrificing in front of a holy God. Now, of course, they also know the history of this ark at this point. They know that when it fell into the hands of the Philistines, how Dagon fell down in front of that ark and how the Philistines ended up just putting it on a cart with a cow and just saying, wherever it goes, it goes. And it went back to Israel. They know that you don't touch this thing. They know that this is their most holy object. And so they are making sure to worship God all the way along, appease the wrath of God, keep killing animals, sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. We're moving the ark. We don't want to die. So sacrifice all the way along. King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled with him were with him before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. Verse 6, then the priests brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place into the inner sanctuary of the house, to the most holy place under the wings of the cherubim. Do you remember the description? that inside the holiest place, there were angels with 30-foot wingspans that covered the back wall so that the Ark of the Covenant, which had angels on the Kippureth with wings that wrapped around and touched in the middle, that sat between the two angels. For the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubim made a covering over the ark and its poles from above. Now I'm going to stress something here that I know that I've stressed many, many times here, but sometimes we have people listening on the internet for the first time, and whenever they hear this, I don't know why it's so revelatory to folks. But you'll notice how often the ark here is called the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, like in verse 6. Because the ark itself and the contents of the ark itself are all about the covenant that God made with Israel. And Solomon is about to say that very thing, that this is the Ark of the Covenant that God made with Israel. And what is inside the Ark of the Covenant is the Ten Commandments. Those Ten Commandments are referred to in the book of Exodus as the words of the covenant. And they are written on tables of stone that are called the tables of the covenant. And they are put inside a box that is called the Ark of the Covenant. In other words, and I just keep stressing this, this entire form of worship that surrounds the Ark of the Covenant all has to do with the Old Covenant, the covenant that God made with Israel at Mount Sinai, which is why it's called the Ark of the Covenant. It is the Ark that contains the words of the covenant that was formed very specifically with a very specific people. And you and I, Marilyn, weren't there. We're Gentiles. We weren't there when that happened. Our ancestors weren't there when that happened. Because they are the people of this covenant, they have a tremendous number of promises. Paul talks about it. What advantage then does Israel have? And he says, actually many. And he starts with, the covenants belong to them. The promises were made to the fathers. And concerning Israel, Christ came. All of this belongs to Israel by covenant. Any Israelite who ends up in God's eternal presence is ending up there because God made promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God is keeping those promises because they're made in covenantal ways. So it's really important for us to understand that we are the children of God by grace, that we don't deserve. Israel is referred to as the children of God because of covenant that God made with them, specifically because they are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he made an unconditional promise to Abraham. And so Israel is brought into covenant. But the Ten Commandments, very frequently you'll hear preachers call the Ten Commandments the moral law that they say is incumbent on all people through all time. They might be willing to admit that the 613 rules of the Mosaic law, the Sinai law, that those 613 rules, those might be done away with, or at least partially. It depends if they divide the law up into ceremonial and civil and moral. But no matter how they explain the church's relationship to the law, and no matter how much of the law they say is done away with, they seem to cling to the Ten Commandments and say, but those are the everlasting, overarching moral rules that are incumbent on all people all the time. I even heard a pastor one time say that the Ten Commandments were imposed on Adam and Eve, even though they didn't have them in written form yet. I know. And I immediately asked the guy who was postulating this, because it was in conversation, I said to him, do you really need to tell a man who's only got one wife not to commit adultery? Is that really necessary? I mean, it's kind of, the field is pretty narrow, but he was saying that as soon as God said, don't touch that tree, that he was saying, don't steal, you know, and don't lust after things that aren't yours, and this kind of stuff. So he was trying to impose the Ten Commandments as a universal, overarching moral law all the way back into Adam and Eve in order to show how universal they were. But throughout the Bible, this is why I keep emphasizing this, the Ten Commandments are the words of the covenant on tables of covenant in the Ark of the Covenant and the covenants made with Israel. So those Ten Commandments are specifically the rules of the covenant that God made with Israel. And that is one of the reasons why we now, in the New Covenant, one of the real obvious things is we don't keep the Sabbath, which would be Saturday, the seventh day. Nor are we required to let our land lay fallow. Nor do we have years of Jubilee, because we're not under the Sabbath rules, including the weekly Sabbath. And the writer of Hebrews certainly explains that. So I just want to reemphasize that one more time, that whenever you hear now about the Ark of the Covenant or the contents that are in it, it's always talking about the covenant God made with Israel. Don't confuse that. So let's pick up at verse 8. Of course, they had the poles with which they carried the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 8, the poles were so long that the ends of the poles could be seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen outside. And they're there to this day. Now, here's a bit of controversy. Look at verse 9. Verse 9 says, there was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. There's that covenant language again, having to do with the tablets of stone that are inside the Ark of the Covenant. But notice that it says there was nothing in the Ark of the Covenant except the two tablets of stone. Somebody look up Hebrews 9:4 for a moment. Hebrews 9:4. Somebody got it? You got it? Read it out loud, nice and loud. Stand up. Stand up so everybody can hear you. Stand up and say it loud enough that the internet people can hear you. People on the other side of the planet are listening. Speak loud. Speak up. Talk loud.
It's in the middle of the sentence.
Are you talking yet?
Yes.
Okay, read from 9:3.
Okay. And behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant.
Okay, now notice first off, the Ten Commandments there are called the tablets of the covenant. Big clue, because the writer of Hebrews would know that historically that's what these are. The words of the covenant are on the tablets of the covenant. But he names three things that are inside the Ark of the Covenant. He mentions the golden pot that had the manna and Aaron's rod that budded. He said these were all inside the Ark of the Covenant. And yet when we read here, there was nothing in the Ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel. So we have what looks like a little conundrum now. There have been lots of different commentaries and writers who have addressed this. Let's start by looking at Exodus 16, 33 and 34, and let me show you a little language thing, and then we'll discuss the ways that this could be harmonized. Exodus 16, 33 and 34 is talking about the pot of manna. Moses said to Aaron, take a pot and put an omer full of manna therein, and lay it up before the Lord to keep for your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. So the verse itself says that it was laid up before the Lord or before the testimony, which means that it actually could have been set outside the box itself, so that it's laid up in front of the testimony, or inside the box. The language is not specific. It just has to be laid up before the testimony and before the Lord. Similarly, in Numbers 17:10, just listen, you don't have to turn there, the Lord said to Moses, put back Aaron's staff in front of the Ark of the Covenant Law. Notice that phrase, by the way, the covenant law. Just thought I'd point that out. Put it in front of the Ark of the Covenant Law to be kept as a sign to the rebellious And this will put an end to their grumbling against me so that they will not die. This verse says that the staff of Aaron was placed in front of the ark. And so it's possible that originally they were placed outside the ark, but were always with it, which would allow then for the statement that there was nothing inside the ark except for the tablets of the covenant to still be true. And then it may be that at some later date, the other two objects were eventually put inside the ark so that the writer of Hebrews said that the cup and the rod that budded were also in the ark. But there is another really interesting theory about this. And actually, John Gill himself proposes this theory. He says the preposition en, the Greek preposition, sometimes signifies at or sometimes with, as in Colossians 3:1 or John 1:28. And so the sense of the Hebrews passage is that these things were near unto it, or near unto it in the most holy place, and might be in the sides of it, though not actually within it. So there were places on the sides of the ark to put things into, so that they would be in the ark but not on the inside of the ark. John Gill argues from the Greek way that the preposition en is used. Even if the pot of manna and Aaron's bud were located by the side of the ark, they could still be considered then to be in the presence of Yahweh, just like Exodus 16:33 demands, because Yahweh dwelt between the angels. I think the most comfortable way to understand all of it is exactly what Gill said, that these objects were always with the ark, that they may have even been attached to the ark on the outside in some significant way, but they weren't under the caporeth inside the box. And if that's the case, 1 Kings 8:9 would be accurate in saying there was nothing in the ark except the two tables of stone that Moses put there at Horeb. Did we just confuse anybody? Or does that kind of make sense? I'm just pointing out yet again that there is a controversy to be had right there, but it's not a fatal controversy. It's one that can be resolved by looking closely at the language. Because our critics love to point at stuff like that and say, oh, look, the Bible contradicts itself. It's possible that there's no contradiction and that instead of being in the ark, the pot of manna and Aaron's rod were with the ark inside the temple or the tabernacle. Make sense? We're nowhere near where I wanted to be at this point. I meant to move faster than that, but these things interest me, so I got busy explaining. Verse 9, there was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And it came about when the priests came from the holy place. Look at this. Once they went in and they set the Ark of the Covenant in the holy place, in the inner chamber, in the temple Solomon built, that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. So God made clear that he accepted all those sacrifices. He accepted this house of the Lord that he himself had assigned Solomon to build. And then he made his presence known. And I like the phraseology that when the presence of the Lord was in the temple, even the priests couldn't stand. And you don't do your work. You just worship. God's here. There's nothing more to do. Get down on your face in front of God. The priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house. So then Solomon addressed the people, and he said, the Lord has said that he would dwell in the thick cloud, and I have surely built thee a lofty house, a place for thy dwelling forever. And then the king faced about and blessed all the assembly of Israel while all the assembly of Israel was standing. And he said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who spoke with his mouth to my father David and has fulfilled it with his hand, saying, Since the day that I brought my people Israel from Egypt, I did not choose a city out of all the tribes of Israel in which to build a house that my name might be there, but I chose David to be over my people Israel. Now it was in the heart of my father David to build a house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to my father David, because it was in your heart to build a house for my name, you did well that it was in your heart. Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son who shall be born to you, he shall build the house for my name. Now the Lord has fulfilled his word which he spoke. For I have risen in place of my father David, and I sit in the throne of Israel, as the Lord promised. And I have built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. And there I have set a place for the ark, in which is the covenant of the Lord, which he made with our fathers when he brought them from the land of Egypt. What did he consider the ark to be? He said, there I set in place a place for the ark, in which is in the ark. Remember what we were told very specifically. What is in the ark? The two tablets of stone that Moses put in there at Horeb when the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel, when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. That's all that's in the ark. And then Solomon says, I have set a place for the ark in which is the covenant of the Lord. So what are the Ten Commandments? They are the covenant of the Lord. That's the Bible. That's what it says. The Ten Commandments are not primarily a moral rule established and incumbent on all people everywhere through all time. They are the tablets of the covenant established between God and Israel. And the Bible keeps saying that over and over and over again. So we have to think that way. When we say Ten Commandments, we have to think about what they are, why they were established, how they were established, and with whom they were established, and the covenant that they were set to establish. Make sense? Okay. There I have set a place for the Lord in which is the covenant of the Lord, which he made with our fathers when he brought them from the land of Egypt. And Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of all the assembly of Israel, and he spread out his hands toward heaven, and he began to pray. I like everything about this. We're going to read through this prayer and call it a night. I like that he stood before the altar, which means he stood up on that high place so the people could all see him. And when he prayed to God, he prayed toward heaven, and he raised up his hands. He was Pentecostal. But notice the posture. Because we've been kind of fed the tradition that when you pray to God, you have to close your eyes and put your head down. No, to pray to God, to ask to God, to speak to God, to worship and praise God as he's about to do, includes the posture of head up, arms wide, hands toward heaven, talking to God Almighty. And he said, notice the first thing he does. He praises God. Remember a couple weeks ago we talked what it is to praise? We discussed what it is to praise, and I think we praised Jason, right? Is that what we did?
That's right.
We praised Jason as our example. And I showed the difference between saying you're going to praise him and actually praising him. It's not enough to just say, we praise you, God. Oh, praise you, God. You are praiseworthy. Praise you, God. Here, we'll try it with Thaddeus. Oh, Thaddeus, we praise you. Does that mean anything to you? No. But what if I say, Thaddeus, you're a good guy. You have a spirit of helps. You're always quick to lend a hand. You're always right there for people. Now I'm praising Thaddeus. I'm saying good things about Thaddeus. That's what praise is. Okay, that's how Solomon starts the prayer. Listen to this. O Lord, the God of Israel, there is no God like thee in the heaven above or on the earth beneath, who art keeping covenant and showing loving kindness to thy servants who walk before thee with all thy heart, who has kept thy servant, my father David, that which thou hast promised him. Indeed, thou hast spoken with thy mouth and hast fulfilled it with thy hand as it is this day. That's praise. You're the God of everything. You're the God who made everything. You're the God of covenant. You're the God who keeps promises. You're the God who said this would happen, and here it is. That's a great way to pray. Then he does something very interesting that we've talked about before when we've discussed prayer. I've said, take God's word back to him. Know what God has said, know what God has promised, and then take his word back to him and say, God, this is what you promised. That's the same thing that Daniel did when he prayed to God from Babylon and said, you said it was going to be 70 years. I'm just asking you to keep your word and make it 70 years. Well, now Solomon engages in much the same thing. Verse 25. Now therefore, O Lord, the God of Israel, keep with thy servant David, my father, that which thou hast promised him. You made a promise to David? Now just do it. That's all I'm asking. Keep your word. This is what you said. You said, you shall not lack a man to sit on the throne of Israel if only your sons take heed to their way to walk before me as you have walked. He quotes it. He says, this is what you promised my father. I'm just asking that you keep your promise. That is a great way to pray. Start by worshiping God. Start by praising God. And then remind him of what he has already said. Verse 26. Now therefore, O God of Israel, let thy word, I pray thee, be confirmed, which thou hast spoken to thy servant, my father David. In other words, just keep your word and confirm your word. Verse 27. But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, the heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain thee. How much less this house which I have built. Do you hear the humility in that? The king of Israel, who God is making the wealthiest, wisest king on the planet. Later, the queen of Sheba is going to come and see him just to see his wealth and to see his splendor. And she's going to say, I heard about it. I couldn't imagine it. Now I've seen it, and I wasn't told the half of it. Okay, that's the power and the splendor Solomon has. And yet, when he's talking to God, he says, I've been 20 years building this. So much gold and brass, we lost count. This is the very house you wanted built in the very place you wanted it built. And now that it's done and you even showed up in a thick cloud, I gotta admit, this couldn't hold you. This isn't a house where you could live, even though it's what I built. But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain thee, how much less this house which I have built. Yet have regard to the prayer of thy servant and to his supplication, O Lord my God, to listen to the cry and to the prayer which thy servant prays before thee today, that thine eyes may open toward this house night and day, toward the place of which thou hast said, my name shall be there, to listen to the prayer which thy servant shall pray toward this place. And listen to the supplication of thy servant and of thy people Israel when they pray toward this place. Hear thou from heaven thy dwelling place, hear and forgive. If a man sins against his neighbor and is made to take an oath, and he comes and he takes an oath before thine altar in this house, then hear thou in heaven and act and judge thy servants, condemning the wicked by bringing his way on his own head and justifying the righteous by giving him according to his righteousness. When thy people Israel are defeated before an enemy because they have sinned before thee, if they turn to thee again and confess thy name and pray and make supplication to thee in this house, then hear thou in heaven and forgive the people, thy people Israel, and bring them back to the land which thou didst give to their fathers. When the heavens are shut up and there is no rain because they have sinned against thee and they pray toward this place and confess thy name and turn away from their sin when thou dost afflict them, then hear thou from heaven and forgive the sin of thy servants and of thy people Israel. Indeed, teach them the good way in which they should walk and send rain on thy land, which thou hast given thy people for an inheritance. And if there is famine in the land, if there is pestilence, if there is blight or mildew, locust or grasshopper, if their enemy besieges them in the land of their cities, whatever plague, whatever sickness there is, whatever prayer and supplication is made by any man Or by all thy people Israel, each knowing the affliction of his own heart, and spreading his hands toward this house, then hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and forgive, and act, and render to each according to his ways, whose heart thou knowest. For thou alone knows the hearts of all the sons of men, that they may fear thee all the days that they live in the land which you have given to their fathers. Also, concerning the foreigner who is not of thy people Israel, when he comes from a far country for thy name's sake, for they will hear of thy great name and thy mighty hand and of thine outstretched arm. When he comes and he prays toward this house, hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and do according to all for which the foreigner calls to thee, in order that all the peoples of the earth may know thy name, to fear thee, as do thy people Israel, and that they may know that this house which I have built is called by thy name. When thy people go out to battle against their enemy, by whatever way thou shalt send them, and they pray to the Lord toward the city which thou hast chosen and the house which I have built for thy name, then hear in heaven their prayer and their supplication and maintain their cause. When they sin against thee, for there is no man that does not sin, and you are angry with them, and you deliver them to an enemy, so that they take them away captive to the land of the enemy, far off or near, if they take thought in the land where they have been taken captive, and they repent and make supplication to thee in the land of those who have taken them captive, saying, we have sinned and committed iniquity, we have acted wickedly, if they return to thee with all their heart, with all their soul, in the land of their enemies who have taken them captive, and they pray to thee toward their land, which thou hast given to their fathers, the city which thou hast chosen, and the house which I have built for thy name, then hear their prayer and their supplication in heaven, thy dwelling place, and maintain their cause, and forgive thy people who have sinned against thee all of their transgressions, which they have transgressed against thee, and make them objects of compassion before those who have taken them captive, that they may have compassion upon them. For they are thy people and thine inheritance, which thou hast brought forth from Egypt from the midst of the iron furnace, that thine eye may be open to the supplications of thy servant and to the supplications of thy people Israel, to listen to them whenever they call to thee. For thou hast separated them from all the peoples of the earth as thine inheritance, as thou didst speak through Moses thy servant, when thou didst bring the fathers forth from Egypt, O Lord God. And it came about that when Solomon had finished praying this entire prayer and supplication to the Lord, he arose from before the altar of the Lord, from kneeling on his knees with his hands spread toward heaven, and he stood and he blessed all the assembly of Israel with a loud voice, saying, blessed be the Lord, who has given rest to his people Israel, according to all that he has promised. Not one word has failed of all his good promise, which he promised through Moses, his servant. May the Lord our God be with us, as he has been with our fathers. May he not leave us or forsake us, that he may incline our hearts to himself, to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, which he commanded our fathers. And may these words of mine, with which I have made supplication before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God night and day, that he may maintain the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel as each day requires, so that all the people of the earth may know that the Lord is God and there is no one else. Let your heart, therefore, be wholly devoted to the Lord our God, to walk in his statutes and keep his commandments as at this day. Now the king and all Israel with him offered sacrifices before the Lord. And Solomon offered for the sacrifice of peace offerings, which he offered to the Lord, 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. So the king and all the sons of Israel dedicated the house of the Lord. And the same day the king consecrated the middle of the court that was before the house of the Lord, because there he had offered the burnt offering and the grain offering and the fat of the peace offering. For the bronze altar that was before the Lord was too small to hold the burnt offerings and the grain offerings and the fat of the peace offerings. So Solomon observed the feast at that time, and all Israel with him, a great assembly, from the entrance of Hamath to the brook of Egypt, before the Lord our God, for 7 days and seven more days, even 14 days. And on the eighth day he sent the people away, and they blessed the king. Then they went to their tents joyful and glad of heart, for all the goodness that the Lord had shown to David his servant and to Israel his people. There we made it to chapter 9. But isn't that wonderful? What a great prayer, because not only did Solomon pray that God would glorify himself by doing what he promised he would do, but then he prayed for the people. He interceded for the people, because yet again, the God of heaven is so magnificent, glorious, and holy that you can't just burst into his sight. You need an intercessor, which is why, again, Christ is so very, very important in your relationship with God. You need someone to stand between you and God, someone that God himself picks. And it is God himself who chose Solomon to be king and to stand that day, to build that house, to build that temple, to bring in the Ark of the Covenant. And then God showed up in a cloud of thick smoke to show his approval of everything that had happened. And then Solomon got up and prayed that wherever the people were, even if they sinned against God and were taken into a foreign country, whatever circumstances they were in, if they remembered that they had sinned against God and they turned toward the temple, wherever they were, and they prayed, he said, just remember this day. Remember that you wanted this built. Remember that you approved of all this. And when someone prays toward this house, hear them, listen to them, and respond to their supplications, and forgive them, and restore them, and just keep your word. Just do what you said you're going to do, because this place is a testimony that you do keep your word. So knowing that God keeps his word, and that he kept his word to David, and that he kept his word to Solomon, and that they had built this magnificent place, and that God himself showed up in this place, it gave Solomon all the confidence to be able to say, when your people pray, hear them and respond to them. Be faithful to them, because you are a God who keeps covenant. So when they pray toward this place, remember your promise to them. And I love the language in verse 51, because they are your people and they are your inheritance that you brought forth out of Egypt. Hear them, because they are your people. And how did they become his people? He chose them out of all the peoples on the earth and said, you're my people. Frequently when I pray for a congregation, one of the things that I will say in opening the prayer is, hear us, God, because you know us. We're your people. That's the only reason you should hear us. Hear us because you chose us. Hear us because we belong to you. Hear us because you've placed your spirit in us. We're in your Son. Your Son is in us. Therefore, hear us. Don't hear me because I, in my brash ego, think I deserve to be heard. Don't hear me because I came bursting into your presence and start demanding things. Hear me for your own sake. Hear me because I belong to you, because you chose me. You already redeemed me. You've already made promises to me. Therefore, I can pray to you. I can come into your presence. And I love Solomon's prayer. Listen, some of this language is so wonderful when he says, may the Lord our God be with us as he was with our fathers. They know that history. They know that God was faithful to the fathers, so I pray that he's going to be with you the way he was with the fathers, and may he never leave us nor forsake us. If that resonates with you, it's because Paul writes in the New Testament to be content with such as you have, because he has said, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. That's a promise you get from God, no matter how bad it is, no matter how he has to correct you, no matter what your circumstances. It's so easy to say, where is God in this? And the answer is, I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. And then the language of that he may incline our hearts to himself. There's sovereignty. Even back there, Solomon understood that for any of our hearts to be inclined toward God, it has to be God that inclines our hearts toward him. Anybody who knows anything about God, even somebody as wise as Solomon, knows that the only way people were ever coming to God is if God chose them, God drew them, God inclined their heart toward him, and then God preserved them. That's the only way that anybody maintains a relationship with God. It was true in Solomon's day. It was true in Adam's day. It's true in our day. It's still true that anybody who has a relationship with God, it's because God decided it, God started it, God maintains it, and it is God who is ultimately going to finish it. And all of that is in this wonderful prayer that Solomon prayed at the establishment of the temple. And it's just good stuff.
It sure is.
And I sure do like it. Next week will be our last week that we'll be here on Wednesday before the Christmas break. So we'll look at God's response to the prayer, because God does respond. And then we'll read briefly about the cities that were given to Hiram, and then the Queen of Sheba seeing the splendor that God has given to Solomon. And then we will leave Solomon in that very good and positive position right through Christmas. And when we come back in the new year, we're going to watch him fall. But for Christmas, we'll leave him standing good, because we're being nice to Solomon here at GCA. All right? Are there questions about that? We covered some ground tonight, but I wanted to get to that natural stopping point, and I wanted to get that prayer in tonight. There's a good example in there of prayer, but good, rich theology, and a good example of how to approach God. On your knees, hands in the air, praying to God about how good he is, reminding him of his own word, and then praying that he would preserve us. Boy, that's just a perfect example of how to pray.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.